Leviticus 16. This is all about the Day of Atonement. The first five verses, or the first four verses, are the garments he wears, etc. And then in verse 5, and he shall take of the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats for a sin offering, and one ram for a burnt offering. And Aaron shall offer his bullock of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make an atonement for himself and for his house. And he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. Now, you all know for a long time that that word, the scapegoat, is Le'Azazel, which is a something, and it's unique because of its article before it. I mean, it's calling forth the uniqueness of something and a single identity.
Could you spell that this word?
Azazel, A-Z-A-Z-E-L. Azazel is one of the most discussed things in ancient Judaism. The mystery of Azazel. Things about it are all over. You remember last time we talked about its similarity with the Babylonian process, where they plucked the hairs off the goat and shouted, "Take and go. Why is this goat waiting here when the sins of the generation are many and are still upon him?" During the plagues, the Hittites sent a scapegoat into the enemy territory in order that it should carry the plague there. Now, without distinction, without exemption, Azazel is considered a supernatural power. And the purpose, one of the main purposes of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and the whole Yom Kippur ceremony, was to get rid of the evil by banishing it to its original source. Now, we studied all that last time we studied Azazel, the demon. Now, Rabbi Ishmael explained that it is named Azazel because it atones for the acts of the fallen angels. And the two main angels that he was, and we'll get more into this in a minute, that he's say it atones for. There are two angels, one named Uz, U-Z-Z, and the other named Azael, A-Z-A-E-L. And those were the leaders of the fallen angels. In retelling the story of the sons of God and the daughters of men, the one, remember we spent so much time on that in a three-year cycle? Who were the sons of God in that which led up to Babylon? The first book of Enoch has Azazel as one of the leaders of the angels who desired the daughters of men. There were some babes. And Enoch also says, the book of Enoch, which for a great period of the history of this Bible was in the Bible, was canon. It was Azazel who taught humans how to manufacture weapons. In other words, it was Azazel who taught humans how to war. And it, also in Enoch, one of the angels that didn't fall, Raphael, is commanded to, quote, bind the hands and feet of Azazel and cast him into the darkness. Make an opening in the wilderness, which is in Dudael, and cast him there. Put him upon the hard, sharp rocks. Now that's the reason in the ceremony of Yom Kippur that they take and back the angel over the edge of the cliff, because the place that they back him over the edge of the cliff is called Dudael. And Dudael is a name that nobody knows what it means. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls teach that Azazel taught men to deal wickedly. Now, you got to, I mean, the word scapegoat there, we miss the mystery by that stupid translation. We're going to see a whole lot of mysteries missed. But as you go through and read about this Azael or Azazel, there were two angels in God's confidence, Shemhazi, Shemhazi, and Azazel. They had God's ear.
One was Azazel.
Huh?
One was Azazel.
One was Azazel. And they asked him, quote, Lord of the universe, did we not warn you on the day of creation that man would prove unworthy of your world? Unquote. God replied, quote, but if I destroy man, what will become of my world? They answered, quote, we will inhabit it. And God asks, quote, will you not sin even worse than man? Unquote. They pleaded, we got a deal for you, God. Let us dwell there a while, and we will sanctify your name. Unquote. And God allowed them to descend previous to the Genesis 6 story, these two angels. And they were at once overcome with lust for Eve's daughter. There's great stories about that, but I won't go into all of them. Shemhazi, one of the demons, or the angels here, they were angels then. In other words, only two sons of God descended, according to this. Shemhazi begat on the daughters of Eve two monstrous sons named Hiwa, H-I-W-A, and Haya, H-I-Y-A. Each of them who ate daily 1,000 horses, 1,000 camels, and 1,000 oxen.
Yeah.
Big guys.
They were giants.
Giants. But we're talking massive giants.
The thing after having witnessed childbirth, how
was
that accomplished?
Probably killed him.
Azazel didn't beget any children at this point, but he was running around. He invented ornaments and the cosmetics employed by women to lead men astray. That was what Azazel did. Besides, he taught them how to
making weapons
of war. He also taught women how to put on makeup and lace. And what he really did, and I can't wait for Harry to hear this, he is the directly responsible for the invention of garter belts.
Yes, true. Did you hear that, Harry?
So what do they don't use these books anymore?
Is this in the Dead Sea Scrolls, or are you
talking about this? This combination of the scrolls and the Book of Enoch. God warned them, the two angels, of the flood, that he was going to destroy all of life. And Shemhazi wept for his sons, who though tall enough to escape the drowning, would have starved to death. One of the sons dreamt of a huge tabletop rock He had a dream, and there were four letters inscribed on this rock. That was the sun Hiwa. The sun Haya dreamed of a fruitful orchard with angels felling the trees until only a single three-branched tree remained. Shemhazai interpreted the dream that only Noah and his three sons would live, and at that point Shemhazai repented and was accepted back into the bosom of God. Azazel did not repent, and he still tempts men to do evil today. And he's the source, or one of the primary sources, of what's called the evil impulse throughout the Kabbalah. And he still tempts men today. That's why the Day of Atonement is necessary. Okay?
Now, these guys, Shem and Azazel, and
Shemhazai and Azazel,
they're called God's sons, but they're not begotten sons.
No, they're angels. They're created.
Yeah. But there's a difference between a regular angel and these guys.
Angelology. This is angel stuff. This is angel stuff. These happen to be part of the angels that went bad.
Are any of these guys Satan also? Lucifer, or is he?
Not directly, no. We'll see that in a minute. The Zohar says that Shemhazai and Azazel were seduced by two demonesses, Naama and Lilith. And they then produced the beings which tempted the daughters of men. So it's a slightly different twist to that Genesis 6:1 story. You understand? The point of this, Azazel has been around for a long time and he's a bad dude.
Where did the demons come from?
Huh?
Where did the demons come from?
It was Adam's first wife, Lilith.
Well, I don't understand that, but where did they come from?
God created him.
Okay.
You remember, you weren't here when we studied the creation of those two?
No.
That was bananas.
That was bananas? Oh.
They were trying to take them after that.
No, I'll tell you the story. Lilith was the first woman created. God.
Hold on.
What?
This one Harry told me.
This is the truth. This is the truth.
Okay.
Lilith was the first. In other words, what some of these ancient books say, the ancient teachings say that Eve wasn't the first woman created. Lilith was. And some say Lilith and Naama. But what happened was God created Lilith out of the dust of the earth, just like he had created Adam. But Adam had defecated in the earth, and therefore some of it got mixed in, and that's where the demonesses came from. That's I'm just repeating a story. Don't I didn't make this up.
If you could have made it up, though, you would.
Huh?
It does sound like you're doing that.
So that gives you a little bit more information about Azazel.
Doesn't the Book of Enoch say that Azazel or the other one started teaching man magic and all that kind of junk too? Is it?
Mm-hmm. No, it says he taught the two things, the creation of weapons of warfare and warfare. I say that. I mean, those are the only two references I found that it said, but there may be others. Any questions about Azazel? You understand that the reason I'm bringing this up is if you just read Leviticus 16:8-10, and you see the word scapegoat, what the hell does that mean? It's got an article before it, so it's Le Azazel, and it's a power or a demon.
The point for the study is that
you know, a Hebrew reading this book would have been familiar with that mythology. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Anybody, I mean, to them, that is what it would have meant.
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
So their concept was this Le'Azazel, i.e. the goat, was being taken and sent out and back to its source.
No, it was a goat for Azazel.
The goat was just a goat.
It wasn't a sacrifice because it wasn't ritually slaughtered. You remember we studied this?
Yeah,
but the goat which was dispatched for Azazel was not a sacrifice since it was not ritually slaughtered. The goat may not have even been killed. It was just taken out and pushed over the edge of the cliff. Remember? In order for something to be a sacrifice, in order for the word sacrifice to be applied to it, it has to meet the rules of Tamid, which is the rules of sacrifice. That's why you can't present your body a living sacrifice wherever you think about it. I mean, you can't choose the place of sacrifice, otherwise it's not a sacrifice. The act of sacrificing, however, in the Talmud, if you are sacrificed, it's a metaphor for that is called being baptized. But you're being baptized for the dead, and that's what Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, you know, why then do we baptize for the dead? Why do I stand in jeopardy? In other words, he's talking about his life was at risk every moment as being baptized for the dead, i.e. as being a martyr. But, you know, denominations have made hay over that. Mormons are still up there baptizing at this moment for the dead. You know, dunking somebody and saying, this is for Aunt Ella. And it's just because they don't know the Talmud. All right, so everybody clear on Azazel, but it's an important phenomenon. And when we come next year to the study of Yom and the celebration of Yom Kippur, we'll understand Azazel a little better.
Matt, he's stuck. He is stuck in limbo. Is it
chained up someplace?
The sacrifice. You remember everything. Everything is a parable. Christ said, "All things are parables." Okay. All that this is a parable for what's happening in your mind. In this view of the parable, Gary Buckner is Azazel. Larry Ferguson is Azazel. Do you understand what I'm saying? When Azazel was sent away by the act of, you know, one goat for God, one goat for Azazel, then when the goat was sacrificed for Azazel, its function was to take away into the wilderness, into a place not inhabited, the consciousness of sin for the nation of Israel. At the moment that Christ was baptized, John the Baptist said, "Behold the goat of God that taketh away the sin of the world." He was saying, in effect, "Behold the goat of God for Azazel." You have no right now to have even a consciousness of sin or mistake. It's impossible if you understand the efficacy of Christ. So the understanding of Azazel is an understanding of your freedom. You got it? you know, you...
The lambs that were sacrificed carried away the sin of the people, and the scapegoat carried away the temptation.
No. The lamb was never a sin offering. Not once.
One of them was for Jehovah, one was for Azazel.
Goats.
Okay, goats. The one that was sacrificed was for...
For God,
the people.
To meet the just demands of God,
the, one that was
the setting of blood.
To take away the temptation?
No, to take away the consciousness of it.
Okay, I think I got it.
So that you, otherwise, if there remained a consciousness of sin,
the sacrifice
was not, had no efficacy.
Oh, okay.
That's why it says, there therefore remaineth a rest to the people of God. The rest is, to understand this, that's the biggie.
Why Azazel? I mean, why not say some other entity? Was it because he was by tradition bound in these rocks in this place, and so he represented this?
He represented the force within you, which gives you the consciousness of sin, lust, error, evil inclination. You understand?
So Christ takes that away from our real identity and puts it back on our old identity.
Right, at the base of the rocks.
Dead.
When Paul says that it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwelleth within me, that, I mean, when you talk
could just
about
be, it, you could just replace it with Azazel.
It's
okay, now go to Hebrews 10.
So is one then is for the deed, and the other is for the remembrance.
Or the consciousness of the deed.
Okay.
One is for God. The blood is always for God.
Mm-hmm.
The blood, and remember when we studied the Passover, the blood is on the outside of the door. It didn't do you a damn bit of good unless God sees it. You're not sitting there looking at the blood. All right.
Hebrews
10. For the law, having a shadow, parable, metaphor, pattern, schematic drawing of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year, continually, make the comers thereunto perfect. For then would they not have ceased to be offered? Because that the worshippers, once purged, should have had no more conscience or consciousness of sins. You understand? This is a biggie. Because it destroys your attempts at getting it right. Because if you have no need ever again to worry about getting it wrong, i.e. make a mistake, i.e. sinning, then you will have no more propensity to try to get it right. You'll just live.
And so if we fully apprehend this Azazel scapegoat offering, whatever it is, the blood offering, and the other one, then our freedom is complete.
Yeah.
We're just blasted out into...
That's why 10 days after Yom Kippur is the marriage supper, tabernacles. Or not 10 days, what is it? It's 15 days. Well, in other words, it's the last thing that's done before the marriage. Before the real it is finished. I mean, before it's done.
Yeah.
What we've studied thus far is essentially the concept of exorcism, demonology, through the time of Malachi. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of demons weren't really a big thing in the period of Jewish history from, you know, other than these stories. You know, there was a couple stories.
When was the time of Malachi?
400 B.C. When prophecy is supposedly ended.
Okay, demons from the beginning of time to Malachi.
Right.
Okay.
They were there at some specific points in time, like Abraham's core of great darkness. They were there at the sons of God and the daughters of men, you know, different times. They were there at Abraham's temptation, the last consecration, namely the offering up of Isaac. But there were only at critical points along this timeline. But now we come to this period called the Intertestament period. And we begin to see massively the concept of dualism. And dualism was a result in history, in the history of thought. It was a result of the Persian influence, the Zendavesta, the Zoroastrianism, etc. And dualism has now began to influence Jewish writings, the non-canonical Jewish writings and activities and belief systems, massively. And dualism means that, in essence, that God and the forces of good and truth are opposed in heaven and on earth by powerful forces of evil and deceit. And it's almost, they become, in effect, equal participants in a warfare.
You said this came out of where? A lot of this came out of where?
Persia.
Persia, and did it come vis-a-vis the Jews that were still there coming back in?
Yeah. Well, and Persian thought dominated for this period. But in Persia, in the Zendavesta, the good God was Ormuzd, O-R-M-U-Z-D, and he was opposed by an equal evil god, Ahriman, A-H-R-I-M-A-N, the evil god. And this, the opposition, the struggle between Ormuzd and Ahriman defined religious thought. Yeah, well, it still does. Now, Jewish thought drew also on creating an elaborate demonology from native Jewish sources. The role of Satan is now expanded to make him essentially equal with God in a battle to the death. And evil spirits really enter into the picture now. Now, this is the time, 400 years, it's the time, you know, the time before Christ. Evil spirits are led by a prince called Belial. Sometimes he's called Mastema, M-A-S-T-E-M-A-H. Sometimes he's called Satan. But he's an evil beyond evil. And he's got a whole range of forces at his disposal.
You're saying the Persians brought all this in?
Well,
the Persian influence altered the
View of the understanding of demons. But, I mean, they didn't bring anything new. It was always there, but because of the influence of the rabbis really didn't pay much attention to demons as they did, you know, in all these other societies around. I mean, demonology was a big, big deal in everything, but and all of the things that were done in the name of religion were things that were done to prevent something evil from happening. Well, do you understand? I mean,
that's our thought now. I mean, yeah.
That's what religion is.
But the Hebrews generally just didn't...
They didn't buy into that.
Yeah, they were...
Until the Intertestament period, when the prophecy stopped.
Oh, okay.
The problem is not truly the Persians, it's just that's where the seat of...
That's where it became formalized. I mean, it's always been around, but it was the Persian influence on Judaism that caused this dualism to come into being. You understand?
Does it matter how the Persians got in there to exert the influence?
Well, yeah, it mattered because that was the source. You know, again, according to the ancient rabbinical writings, Daniel was the teacher of Zoroaster. And Zoroaster became the author of the Zendavesta.
It's really a heresy of Judaism.
So the Zendavesta or Zoroasterism is a heresy of Judaism, as John said. And but it's the, what you'll see, though, as we develop this line of thought, is that modern religion is influenced more by the Persians than it is by Moses.
Yeah.
And your thought process, the way you think and view the world, is influenced more by the Zend Avesta than it is by the Bible.
That's because of our culture and everything that bombarded us.
Right. Okay?
I didn't know there was another way to think.
Well, there's a thousand ways to think.
Yeah, but I mean, just, that's the only thought that anybody has that you know of.
No, I didn't. No, that's the advantage of travel. That you find out that you don't worship your thoughts anymore.
I've been to Arkansas.
Well, surely you must know.
No, I'm serious. You begin to be exposed, and you'll either become a total agnostic, or you'll see through that and see the truth. I mean, it's impossible to maintain this. Well, anyway, I won't get to that. All right.
I know that there's different ways of thinking, but it's hard to think that, unless you've been exposed to it, that people don't really go through the same processes of thinking about stuff that I do. I mean, that somebody who lives in China...
That's the definition of provincialism.
Yeah, well...
But I mean, we even see it in here. I mean, you and I don't think in the same way. I mean, and one is not better than the other, but you don't respond to a stimulus the same way that I do. And I mean, that's part of what we see.
But some say near and some say far.
I was thinking something similar to what Larry's getting at, namely that the idea of cause and effect and the idea of opposition both support the position of thought of Zoroastrianism. I mean, and I grant you that's Western, but it's practically universally Western. I mean, it's hard to Western
it's,
something that's not true.
It's Western vis-a-vis, I mean, it's not just one thing. I mean, Zoroastrianism was influenced by the Greek form of deductive thought instead of inductive thought. And so then it became what we have now. I mean, we now worship deductive reasoning. Well, in the past, deductive reasoning was stupid. Induction was the way of knowledge.
Which means what now?
It means by revelation instead of by ordered process of learning.
Yeah, well, our goals are different now. We're trying to make money. Get a kick out of the whole night here. Today, we're talking about technology.
Oh, yeah.
He made me scratch the word technology out of his letter.
Same, that's the idea, yeah.
Yeah.
I got confused. Are demons fallen angels or not?
Yes.
Yes and no.
I thought we said no.
We said yes and no.
We said yes and no.
They may.
Well, anyway, now we begin to see this whole line of thought that the spirits of good and evil are pictured as engaged in this desperate struggle for the souls of men. And in this period of time with Judaism, and therefore it's influenced us and it influenced Christianity, the role of demons is conceived as tempting men to do evil. Where in many, many other cultures, the role of demons is that of inflicting physical harm on people. Now, normally, demons the belief system that demands or that produces the idea that demons run around inflicting physical harm on people is called animism. And then you have to protect yourself by certain rites or religious practices. The idea that demons are around to tempt you to do evil is a major departure from that kind of thinking, and it causes in the spiritual realm, it causes the concept of subtlety. And so from God's standpoint, it's moving closer and closer to this final outline or cosmetic of the bride, because we see it in its opposite. The subtlety. I mean, if a demon, if we believe in the culture where demons were, and the demon's going to come along, he's going to break your leg, unless you gave him an offering, well, that's one thing. That's relatively easy to deal with. That's black or white. But if your belief system says that the demon is the one that's enticing you to do to look at dirty magazines, then it's a far
inside.
Yeah, it's a far subtler, personal kind of process.
More individual. Because there was more individualism in people,
yeah,
as culture increased.
Everyone inward with no exposure, no
right.
confession, no
right.
shame is covered at all.
Right. Well, anyway, as a result, in many passages of the ancient writings, including the Bible, it is difficult to say whether the spirit refers to the demon external to man or as a trait within the human soul. Now, we have this, you know, we have now within the charismatic Pentecostal movement, we have some people within that movement that have identified, you know, 2,000 demons by name. There's a demon for everything that they don't think you should do. Except there's no demon for righteousness, you know, false righteousness. But and so what that does is that it's almost like they are trying to return to this ancient way of thinking, that these are the processes that are external to man that you have to fight against, as opposed to the nature of the beast that has to that's simply there as being an instrument of being tested. You understand?
It all denies the cross, and it all says that you can improve yourself.
Right. By one or the other ways.
Right.
Right. Now, we don't really care about either way. But it's important that we know about these two systems of thinking. Now, Belial is the most common name for the leader of the demons in the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's also in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Let me go. Read 2 Corinthians 6:15. Now, this is where we're going to get into serious Bible study, so let me just use Belial as an example, and then we'll probably quit for tonight, because I don't feel like talking anymore. Okay, read 2 Corinthians 6:15, and read the associated verses.
How far back can we go?
Well,
14?
Well, just where you, I don't have it in front of me, read where you...
Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers,
okay.
For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communication hath light with darkness? And what accord hath, or what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Okay. Now, read that carefully in your own Bibles. This is a biggie. Because Christ said that, you know, in the world you shall have tribulation, but fear not, I have overcome the world. You are in the world, but not of the world. And so he's defining that for which an alliance is permissible. That's what an yoke together means, to have an alliance. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Now, you understand that yoke extends to your belief system. What he's saying here is far more insidious and far more wild than any time you've ever read this before, because you usually personalize this. I mean, that means don't hang around with Joe Blow because he's an unbeliever. But that's not what it says. It says don't be unequally yoked together with, and therefore you have to go back and define what this means. And Paul defined it, and Jesus defined it, but it's the idea that, you know, you are they which justify yourselves among men, but God knows your heart. For those things which are highly esteemed among men are an abomination to God. What this means is, those things for which you have high esteem, and it's common vis-a-vis the Gentile world, that defines you being unequally yoked together with unbelievers. You understand me? It has nothing to do with you running around with people, or...
It's the same thing about eating up those things that are sacrificed.
Same thing. Same thing. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? In other words, in the rules of logic, he is saying that to be unequally yoked together with an unbeliever, to have fellowship with unrighteousness, to have communion with darkness, is Belial. He's not talking about a number of different things. He's explaining one thing.
Yeah. It's like righteousness, light, Christ, and belief, and all these things are one thing, only one thing.
Right.
Belial and darkness and all the other
are the other thing.
So he's taking the Jewish mythology of demons and putting it in a different light.
Totally different light.
Out of the being category into a more...
Right, and we'll get more, we'll see this in a minute. And then he continues on that same line of argument. What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? So we got now idols, Belial, darkness, unrighteousness, unbelievers. You know, touch not the unclean thing, come out from among them, be ye separate. I will be a father unto you, you should be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. Now, Belial is the Hebrew word. It's not a translation, it's a transliteration. And it's Beli, B-E-L-I-Y-Y-A, apostrophe, A-L. Belial, and it means something that has no benefit or no thriving, is equivalent to the word that's translated elsewhere as scoundrel. It means something without eternal merit. Now, you understand by definition then, it's anything other than that which has eternal merit. It's anything other than that which is truth. So the works of Belial are the works of darkness, and the more we walk, the more the eyes of your understanding are opened, the more you see it is only Belial. But Belial is personified here in Jewish thought as a demon. Just as eating the food sacrificed to Gentiles is eating the food sacrificed to demons. So it destroys you. You can't think either way. You know, you can't think about, okay, demons are these guys that are out trying to do me harm and I'm going to protect myself, or you can't excuse it by these things are human traits. God, he pushes you to the only thing you can do is accept the cross. There can be no value system that isn't eternal, that isn't Belial. Now, we may in fact be visited by this personification in terms of this demon and running around and do some stuff, but he's no more different to us as, you know, the temptation to think about a palm tree or something. I mean, it's meaningless. He has no, what's the chaff to the wheat? He is you know, it's the Luther story. He wakes up, sees Satan himself. Oh, it's just you, and he goes back to sleep. There is nothing that can touch you. There's no place in you. But that cannot excuse your sloth vis-a-vis the things that you are giving breath to in the world. Because if you're giving breath to those things in the world, that ugly being will kick your ass. Do you understand the elegance of this test?
The link between the idolatry and the spirit being and that whole, the whole thing is one link.
So. Amen. It's one system or one order of power. It's just wonderful. And he's working only at God's bidding. So that to rid you of the strange God within you. You are they that justify yourselves among men, but God knows your hearts. Those things which are highly esteemed among men or lightly esteemed among men or just a little bit esteemed among men are an abomination unto God.
The fact that you esteem those things is because you have not yet... Because the scapegoat, that whole mystery is you have the consciousness of sin, so you justify yourself to keep from.
And then Belial's going to come and kick your ass.
Same.
Now, when we're going to continue on Belial and see in the Old Testament where it is it's translated some. Because of King James' time, it was just translated as a human trait. We're going to see the places where it's talking about a specific, where it's talking about the demon. But it's translated in the Old Testament as just a human trait. In the same way that we talked about Mavet being death. Now we're going to see it a whole bunch more.
So this is wild, though, because if you go whole hog one direction into the demon as a separate being from you, and you just keep every bad thing about you suddenly as a demon, and you keep casting it out.
You're faced with legion.
Yeah, but if you go the other way, it's just psychological.
It's just psychological.
Then you've missed the element of
You've missed the elegance.
The
person of the
actual
demon.
Actual being.
Yeah.
It's like it's a Mobius strip or something. I mean, it's both sides are the same. Is it the interesting Mobius?
Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
That's the great strip that's twisted and bent in such a way that both sides are the same and you can't get from one side to the other side. Do you know how to make one?
That's what we're going to have the kids do the first day of school is tie their hands behind their back and make them make a Mobius strip. But once you survive...
But the thing that he's saying to the Corinthians, because the whole thing is about sloth, really. I mean, the ones that, you know, where he says you're not straightened, you know, in our minds, but you are in your own.
Yeah.
And he's saying being large, it's like, you know, see that the tiniest moment, the way to say it would be the tiniest moment of faithlessness is like the ultimate betrayal.
It's like worshiping Belial.
And on the other end of the spectrum, I mean, the most horrendous thing you can conceivably do is still covered by the death of Christ. I mean,
amen.
You know, both of those.
Here, use a knife.
You can use a knife on yourself?
And well, I'm going to have to. Anybody have a sword? A machete would be good.
So that it doesn't fall on it?
Huh? Well, he does it so often that I'd just like to have one handy.
Okay, now this would be a regular circle, but if you put one twist in it, this isn't really long enough to do it. But you've got a Mobius strip. You start on one side. You're going down the road here.
There is only one side. That's the weird thing.
And see, you're up here, and then you go through here. You come back around this way, and you're back. I mean,
you can't get from the top to the bottom. I mean, there's no...
It's one side.
You can't think about it. If you try to think about a Mobius strip, you'll go crazy.
It's a one-sided object? It's a circle with one twist in it.
And there's only one side.
There's only one side.
It goes on forever.
Now, you know what you did if you cut it in half?
You get two rings together.
No, you don't.
You don't?
Uh-uh.
What do you get?
You just get one. If you take and cut it in half, you get one strip.
Yeah.
That's also a Mobius strip.
And you can cut it in half again and just get a longer one.
Down the middle length.
That's the whole point.
Now, here's the universe is just like this. If you started right here, that this strip,
Doug's universe,
and you traveled in a straight line, yeah, you would show back up in the same place, but you would be a mirror image of yourself.
Because space is curved.
It's also
the definition of an infinite plane.
Yeah, but the idea and reason that's important is an ancient symbolism, a circle, a ring represents truth. One slight twist to the truth represents an infinity that you can't get out of.
You never get back.
You can never close the circle. Yeah, you can never get there from here. One slight twist. That's why really if we could see it, all of math, especially higher math, proves the doctrine.
It also proves that space is curved.
It also proves that space is warped.
Well, just, you know, this whole thing of Belial and the scapegoat, and it takes away the power of shame and guilt. I mean,
because if you retain it,
you have it. So
you have to play in their ball game.
I mean, and what's only that? I mean, if you contend to have it, and you know that's, I mean, I can, that's, it has to be revenged.
Amen. Instantly. Revenge that disobedience. It cannot be excused. You should have been in bananas last night. Boy, did we kick ass.
It's an editorial week.
I kicked ass.
He kicked Wee's ass.
First, anyway, we studied 1 Corinthians 15 and its relationship to the first fruit offering and the counting of the Omer. And it's the chapter about putting down all enemies. And we define the enemies, the enemies of unbelief, doubt, fear, etc., etc. But they can't be excused for an instant. Not for a millisecond, not for a nanosecond. No, because I'm always kicking Lee's ass. I mean, she's like Doug's counterpart. Because she's all, last night it was, being a secretary just isn't important, it's boring, and it doesn't challenge me. Anyway, this is the next phase of the demon stuff gets really interesting because it goes into the Old Testament. We're going into the Old Testament and seeing these words that are just translated as wicked or naughty or something that are talking about they are proper nouns. They're proper names.
Well, we did a little of that.
Yeah, but this is more. Huh?
Wait to get some interesting. Is the Torah that the Jews use today any better translated than what we have available here?
Yeah, in a few instances, but it's confusing because, and many times the chapter and verse is different. And so if we got into it, then, I mean, you couldn't use the concordance and all that kind of stuff. So I made a decision a long time ago that we'd stay with the King James.
I don't think Thompson has a counterpart in the other.
No.
For a reference.
Yeah.
For a reference.
Yeah.
Okay?
This is wild stuff.
Take it, big guy. Now remember...